From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, deadly clashes in eastern Ukraine, India's new leader meeting with regional counterparts in New Delhi. Plus, there is word Nigerian authorities know where the kidnapped girls are located. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Following a day of heavy fighting in which Ukrainian government forces use combat jets to stop separatists from taking over Donetsk airport, bodies of about 30 insurgents were brought to a hospital morgue, according to the separatist Donetsk People's Republic. The pro-Russia fighters involved in the clashes said they belonged to the Vostok Rebellion Battalion. This Donetsk resident said the people of the region can no longer put up with what the Ukrainians are doing. By Tuesday morning, Ukrainian Minister of Internal Affairs Arsen Avakov said government forces had regained full control of the site. He said, "We just reacted to the situation. The result is that the airport is absolutely under our control. The other side had serious losses," he said. "There was no one killed on our side. The operation," he said, "is still going on." The U.S. ambassador to Ukraine says separatists in the eastern part of the country could not be escalating their fight without at least the connivance of the Russian government. In a VOA interview in Kiev, Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt said the separatists are increasingly well-trained. He also spoke about Sunday's presidential election and the way forward for Ukraine and the West. VOA's Al Pessin reporting now from Kiev.
Just a few weeks ago, Russian-backed separatists were a ragtag collection of extremists holding just a few buildings in eastern Ukraine. Now they're an effective military force that has staged successful attacks on the main airport in eastern Ukraine and on several Ukrainian military units. Ambassador Pyatt says they could not have done that on their own.
There's extensive evidence that these groups are coming from across the Russian border. Personally, I'm skeptical that this could be happening without some kind of official, at least, connivance.
The U.S. ambassador condemned the separatist attacks, which he said are designed to create chaos as the country is forming a new government. Pyatt also praised Sunday's election held in most of the country in spite of the violence in the east, and he agreed with official monitors that the result is legitimate, even though many people in two eastern regions were not able to vote.
On balance, we see this as perhaps the freest election in Ukraine's history in terms of the breadth of candidates, the quality of the administrative arrangements, the documented freedom of the press. This was a positive election for Ukraine and for the Ukrainian people.
Ambassador Pyatt says Petro Poroshenko, the apparent presidential winner, has an unambiguous mandate, and that the United States endorses his priorities, bringing peace to the East, reaching out to its people, fighting entrenched corruption, and moving Ukraine closer to the West.
We see this as a way to build prosperity for Ukrainian citizens, as a way to build stability for Ukrainian institutions, and as a way to build a more just and democratic society in this country.
Pyatt says the United States and its partners have already provided fresh economic and military aid, and the process will continue.
One of the categories of goods which we are going to deliver is additional radios to help address some of these issues in terms of command and control, communications, the ability of the Ukrainian military to adapt to a changed security environment.
Ambassador Pyatt says he has no regrets about U.S. support for the pro-Europe movement that led to the ouster of Ukraine's former president and sparked Russia's seizure of Crimea and its meddling in eastern Ukraine. He rejects Russian charges that the United States engineered the movement and calls the eventful last 6 months in Ukraine a revolution of dignity. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kyiv.
President Obama telephoned Petro Poroshenko on Tuesday to congratulate him on his victory in Ukraine's long-awaited presidential election. White House said Mr. Obama offered him the full support of the United States as he seeks to unify and move his country forward. It said that Mr. Obama also stressed the importance of quickly implementing the reforms needed to bring the country together and to develop a sustainable economy. Vatican tourists and clergy on Tuesday welcomed Pope Francis's efforts to tackle child sex abuse by Catholic priests. On Monday, the Pope announced that he will meet with a group of sex abuse victims at the Vatican as part of an effort to go forward with zero tolerance in confronting and preventing clergy abuse. Jane Shawcross was visiting the Vatican Tuesday from the U.S.
We're all the body of Christ. That's what Jesus taught us. So, you know, we all have different gifts. You may be the eyes, I may be the hands, whatever. So if you hurt one of us, you hurt all of us. You know, Christ is in all of us, so someone is hurting Christ when they are hurting a child.
On the way back from his recent three-day Middle East trip, Pope Francis compared child abuse to performing a satanic black mass. Catholic priest Father John Walk reacted Tuesday while on a visit to the Vatican.
By comparing the sexual abuse of minors to a black mass, the Holy Father is trying to drive home the horror, the diabolical horror of abuse. And I think he was doing it for two reasons. He saw a connection for two reasons. One is that Christ himself said, "Whatever you do to the least of my brethren, you do unto me." So when someone abuses the body of another person, they're abusing the body of Christ. And that abuse of the body of Christ is exactly what happens in a black mass, which is a sacrilegious attack on the body of Christ present in the Eucharist.
Pope's meeting with the victims of sexual abuse by priests will mark the first such encounter for the Pope, who has been criticized by victims for not expressing personal solidarity with them when he has reached out to other people who suffer. Far-right, anti-EU parties have made strong gains following European elections. European Parliament in Brussels will now include hundreds of lawmakers whose aim is to break up the union. Henry Ridgewell reporting now from London. Analysts say the results are in part a reaction against the austerity measures imposed by Brussels in the wake of the European debt crisis.
France's far-right National Front Party attracted one in four votes at the European polls Sunday. Party leader Marine Le Pen said the French people no longer want to be ruled from the outside.
Notre objectif est de bloquer avec nos élus toutes les évolutions néfastes de l'Union européenne.
She said the party's objective is to block all damaging European resolutions and to defend the interests of France and the French people. Supporters claim the virulent anti-immigrant rhetoric of the National Front's early years has moderated, but there was shock among immigrant communities in Paris. Mohad Saïd Elouache came to France 5 years ago.
Extreme droite, ils sont dangereux.
The far right is a danger, he says. The far right does not change. They remain the far right. Parties like the National Front combine fears over immigration with concerns over the economy, says Andrea Mamoni, an expert on far-right politics in Europe at Royal Holloway University in London.
The economic situation is part of this problem because reduction of the job market, so more people competing for this, reduction of the welfare, so finding people responsible also for this, so immigrants, competitors.
The result will be felt beyond France, says analyst Yanis Emmanouilidis of the European Policy Centre.
Having a weak France is no good news if you want to do EU policy making.
In Britain, the anti-EU UK Independence Party topped the vote and now holds a third of Britain's 73 seats in the European Parliament. Party leader Nigel Farage vowed to repeat the success in national elections and force a referendum on Britain's EU membership.
If any of you think you've seen the high watermark of UKIP, you ain't seen nothing yet. Thank you.
In Greece, where EU-imposed austerity measures have been felt hardest, the left-wing anti-EU party Syriza topped the poll. There has been a rejection of mainstream political parties in many European countries, says Andrea Mamone of Royal Holloway University.
people have started complaining, saying, why? What's the point that a German politician is telling us to do this and that? Where is the democratic legitimacy of all this?
In Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats topped the poll. She called the rise of anti-EU parties across Europe remarkable and regrettable.
Ist das schon bemerkenswert und auch bedauerlich, aber auch da geht es darum, die Wählerinnen und Wähler wieder zu gewinnen.
Mrs. Merkel said it is up to politicians to win back voters in Germany and also in France. The best way, she said, is to focus on improving competitiveness, on growth and creating jobs. Italians also bucked the trend, giving an emphatic win to the centre-left, pro-EU Democratic Party of President Matteo Renzi. Italy takes over the rotating EU presidency in July, and Mr. Renzi has pledged to focus on jobs and growth in place of austerity. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The people, places and things, both real and imagined, are all part of Daybreak Asia's weekly look at the movies. We report on some of the most fascinating things going on in Asian-related cinema, including interviews with the directors, writers, and producers who make it all happen. We cover the continent and also take a look at some of the most intriguing Asian-themed films here in the United States. I'm Ray Kugel. Join me for a trip to the movies Fridays on Daybreak Asia, and at your convenience, anytime, at voanews.com.
India's new Prime Minister Narendra Modi held talks with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif on Tuesday, with all eyes watching the meeting for signs of a thaw in relations between the often hostile nuclear-armed neighbors. India's Foreign Secretary Sujata Singh spoke with reporters about the meeting.
It was conveyed that Pakistan must abide by its commitment to prevent its territory and territory under its control from being used for terrorism against India. We also expect that necessary steps will be taken in the Mumbai terror attack trial underway in Pakistan to ensure speedy progress of the case and the conviction of those responsible. The PMs agreed that the foreign secretaries will remain in touch and explore how to move forward. The PM said that the two countries could move immediately towards full trade normalization.
And Mr. Sharif also was at that meeting. He said it was a historic opportunity for both of our countries. He also said that as leaders, each elected with a popular mandate, the two men could succeed in turning a new page in the often combative relations between their countries. In addition to his meeting with Pakistani Prime Minister, Prime Minister Modi also met with Sri Lanka's President Mahinda Rajapaksa. South Asia analyst Rafiq Dosani of the RAND Corporation is in India and spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about Mr. Modi's meetings with leaders from neighboring countries. He said the meetings surprised almost everyone, were welcome, and a very sensible thing to do right after his inauguration on Monday.
You know, for a long time, India has been holding back on trying to lead South Asia when no one else can really play that role. This promises well, very well, for South Asian integration. So not just Sharif getting Rajapaksa there, with whom also India has had troubled relations, it's, I think, quite a coup.
He seems to be hitting the ground running with regard to some very tough issues that the two countries face.
Given that Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif came with such a large delegation, one assumes that this is not just a symbolic meeting saying, you know, hello and we'll get to meet again later, but that this very meeting is going to be used to accomplish something.
Domestically, what do you make of the naming of the streamlined cabinet?
You know, there are two ways to look at streamlined. One is you don't have enough people. And second is that you feel you don't need more people. At this point, you know, in his honeymoon period, it's tempting to think of the latter. But my sense is that, you know, by clubbing in ministries like finance and defense, which have absolutely no relationship to each other, it shows in a sense that there's thinness on the ground. I mean, those are two industries which should never be clubbed together. You know, defense relies on heavy funding from finance. It creates conflicts of interest. So my sense is that it's not a compact cabinet by choice, but the shortage of qualified people at this stage. It may also mean that Mr. Modi wants to do many of the things himself and therefore wants to give out very few ministries and is just conveniently clubbing them under a few of his trusted lieutenants like Mr. Jaitley and Venkaiah Naidu. I think one good choice in terms of competence is clearly Sushma Swaraj, who was taken in despite reports of her opposing Mr. Modi and not being that much in favor of him from the beginning. And she's been taken as the External Affairs Minister. And although she doesn't have particular experience in this portfolio, and she actually was quite a disruptive leader of the opposition over the last 5 years, she certainly is one of the kinds of much more accommodating perspective on relations with other countries than some of the other horror stories that one has read about in the BJP, like Mr. Gadkari.
Well, what are the names of that you've heard indicate about the direction policy will take?
My sense is this is going to be very much Mr. Modi-led. You know, he's chosen absolute loyalists, Rajnath Singh and Arun Jaitley, as his key appointees. And he's chosen a competent person, Sushma Swaraj, as his foreign affairs minister. These are the four main portfolios.
South Asia analyst Rafiq Dasani of the RAND Corporation, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. In Thailand, armed troops detained a cabinet minister who emerged from hiding on Tuesday to condemn last week's military coup and urge a return to civilian rule. About a half dozen Thai soldiers took the ousted education minister Chaturan Chasang into custody in a chaotic scene at the Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand in Bangkok, where he had just finished giving a surprise news conference. It was the first public appearance by any member of the ousted government.
Do insist to use my all rights and liberty to call for returning the country to democracy by first calling for the NCPO to return the power to people and to hold election under a democratic rule at the earliest possible.
Chasang went on to say more civil disobedience can be expected.
I believe that from now on there'll be more and more resistance. This is a death of life of Thai society. This is a death of life of Thai people in general, meaning the society will be in a conflicting situation.
Chasang had been in hiding since the coup d'etat last Thursday, refusing to answer summons to surrender himself to an army base. Now faces the prospect of a military court and up to 2 years in jail. The military junta is already holding most top members of the Southeast Asian country's elected administration and has ordered the rest to surrender.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The head of Nigeria's military says the 276 kidnapped schoolgirls have been located, but the military will not attempt to rescue them by force. President Goodluck Jonathan has ruled out negotiating with the kidnappers, the militant sect Boko Haram. VOA's Ann Look has the latest from Abuja.
Nigeria's defense chief, Marshal Alex Bade, says he knows where the girls are, 6 weeks after their kidnapping in northeastern Nigeria. Speaking in Abuja, Bade would give no details about the location. He said a forceful rescue operation would be too dangerous and could kill the girls. But he said military officials are working on it and, quote, know what they are doing, despite accusations to the contrary. President Goodluck Jonathan has ruled out negotiations, including the militants' demand for a prisoner swap. He said Sunday the girls must be released unconditionally. It's unclear what options remain or what role these public statements could be having in any back-channel talks. Presidential Senior Special Advisor on Public Affairs, Doyin Okupe.
But I'm sure government has a program, you know, and even if I know, I cannot say it on air. You know, but there is definitely, because, you know, there is an overwhelming commitment by government, especially the president, that these girls, within the shortest period of time, you know, must be found and must be released. So I'm sure they have something up their sleeves.
VOA spoke by phone with family members of the missing girls about what the military chief called the, quote, good news that the girls had been located. Those relatives said their hopes have been raised before. They say they'll believe it when they see the girls home safe. Attacks either claimed by or blamed on Boko Haram continue to occur in northern Nigeria, leaving hundreds dead this month. Analysts warn that militants could grab more students or civilians, even if the Chibok schoolgirls are freed. Nigeria accepted assistance from the United States and other countries to help find the girls, but Nigeria has ruled out a foreign troop deployment. And look, VOA News, Abuja.
As Egyptian military supporters celebrate their triumph over the Muslim Brotherhood, youth activists say their own support base has dwindled and opposing the government is increasingly dangerous. But they say going forward, they hope to redefine Egyptian politics as neither for nor against Islamism, but for or against democracy. Heather Murdoch has more from Cairo.
For many Egyptian voters, this week's election was not a vote for anyone. Opposition voters said they were not so much supporting Hamdi Sabahi as not voting for Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Egypt's former army chief who has been running the country for nearly a year. Many Sisi supporters said they were not so much voting for Sisi, but against the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi, who was ousted from the presidency last year and still claims the seat from a jail cell. At a polling station in Cairo, this woman, Amal, says she came out to vote, so Mr. Morsi cannot come back. Amal says the election has quieted fears about a return to chaos. Since Mr. Morsi was thrown out of office, politics in Egypt has grown increasingly violent, and thousands have been killed or arrested. Spokesperson Fekri Nabil of Strong Egypt, a party that boycotted this week's elections, says parties like his need to redefine Egyptian politics.
We found that there is a great polarization in the society itself to divide it between Islamist and non-Islamist. And from our point of view, it was not the real battle or the real fight we need to have. We need to have fight for whom? With democracy and whom against democracy.
After the 2011 revolution, many new political parties were formed, like the Egypt Freedom Party, a centrist group that attracts young members. Party Secretary General Shahir George says since Sisi's rule began, many party members have fled, fearing retribution for opposing the military.
The challenge we face is how to win the trust of the crowd once more again, because this is where we're lacking support these days. There is a popularity of stopping street acts. There is a popularity of ignoring human rights for the time being.
But young political parties that want neither military nor religious rule have been stymied by infighting. George says moving forward requires taking a clear stance, not only against repression, but for human rights.
And now we need to focus more on how to build a solid opposition that would have a clear vision on economic and social rights in parallel to political and civil rights.
At the polls, voters said they would have liked more choices, but the young parties are too inexperienced and too fragmented. The future for new political parties in Egypt is uncertain, and members report arbitrary arrests and harassment, saying opposition to the government these days is viewed either as ignorance or a crime. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Cairo.
Defender Atsuto Uchida scored late in the first half Tuesday when Japan beat Cyprus 1-0 in the team's final match on home soil before departing for the World Cup. Japan, which is preparing for its fifth consecutive World Cup campaign, will be facing Ivory Coast, Greece, and Colombia, all of them in Group C when play begins next month in Brazil. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On May 28, 1754, Virginia militia officer Lieutenant Colonel George Washington led a force that attacked and defeated a French reconnaissance party in southwest Pennsylvania. The battle is considered the beginning of hostilities known in North America as the French and Indian War. In 1830, President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act, giving the U.S. government access to lands inhabited by Indian tribes. Thousands from several tribes were forced to give up their land and move west. Many died on the way in what became known as the Trail of Tears. In 1843, American lexicographer Noah Webster died. Webster is best known for an American Dictionary of the English Language, published in 1828. In 1934, quintuplets were born to a Canadian couple. The five Dion babies became the first quints known to survive infancy. In 1937, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, California, was officially opened by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. The president pushed a button in Washington, D.C., signaling the start of traffic over the bridge, which at the time was the longest suspension bridge in the world. In 1964, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, was formed. It was eventually recognized as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people by over 100 countries. Early on, the PLO was responsible for attacks against Israelis, but has since officially renounced armed resistance against Israel. In 2002, the Mars Odyssey probe found evidence of ice deposits on the planet Mars. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
20 years ago, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, entered into force, setting the stage for a 20-year period of even greater economic cooperation between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. In that time, U.S. investment in Mexico increased sixfold, while Mexican investment in the U.S. economy grew by a factor of 12. The United States and Mexico have integrated our economies, creating good jobs and new opportunities for citizens of both our countries, said Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs Roberta Jacobson before the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee. The United States and Mexican manufacturing economies build products together for the North American market and globally. Cultivating this relationship has allowed our citizens to realize one of the key benefits of economic integration, increased competitiveness, that forms the basis for good jobs and prosperity, said Assistant Secretary Jacobson. In May 2013, President Obama and Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto announced the U.S.-Mexico High-Level Economic Dialogue to further deepen and elevate economic cooperation. Through the dialogue, the United States and Mexico work to promote mutual economic growth, job creation, and global competitiveness, underscoring the long-standing importance and dynamism of our economic relationship. One important element of the dialogue is the shared recognition that entrepreneurship, innovation, and education drive successful economies. The Mexico-U.S. Entrepreneurship and Innovation Council supports innovative practices in both countries by organizing business plan competitions, supporting women entrepreneurs, developing technology projects, and much more. The United States and Mexico are also increasing cooperation in higher education to sustain the economic gains of the last 20 years, as well as create jobs and opportunities for the next generation. Ongoing U.S.-Mexico security cooperation underpins these goals by building safe and secure communities where our economic partnership can flourish. Under the North American Leaders Summit, we are also cooperating on regional energy security. We're building on the strong foundation of decades of trade integration, said Assistant Secretary Jacobson. Like us, our neighbors want to unlock the massive potential of our citizens and our economies, not just each of us acting alone, but both of us together. The Mexican government seeks strategic engagement with us, capitalizing on our shared values and our common border to promote regional security, open new markets to trade, and maximize our leadership in the Western Hemisphere and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.